You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of the Complete Collected Works, Volume 175 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context, 17 lectures given in Berlin, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange. This is Lecture 2, given in Berlin on the 13th of February, 1917. The thoughts that we formulated a week ago were focused on the insight that anyone with a knowledge of spiritual realities is well aware that, even though outwardly a materialistic view, a materialistic outlook on the world, has reached its culminating point, we are nevertheless inwardly at present in the initial phase of a dematerializing of thoughts and of the world of ideas, and that in the course of time this will lead to a spiritualizing of earthly life, an imbuing of earth existence with the spirit. This renewing impulse, which is to take hold of outward life on the physical plane, must first be understood and formulated by some, and then by increasing numbers of people in a spiritual way. And spiritual science needs in this respect to begin the process whereby human beings are inwardly uplifted to what can become accessible to human souls today if they do but will it, to that of which outward physical life is not as yet a reflection, though it must become so, if the earth is not, in a certain sense, to be engulfed in the decline of materialistic evolution. One could describe man's present situation by saying that his soul is, in general terms, actually very close to the spiritual world. But the ideas, and especially the feelings, deriving from a materialistic conception of the world and a materialistic attitude toward it, have cast a veil over what is in actual fact closely affiliated to the human soul. The connection between physical earth existence, where people today, in spite of many assertions to the contrary, are firmly rooted with their whole being, and the spiritual world, can be found by human beings if they try to develop the inner forces of courage to understand not only what nature displays before their outer senses, but also what remains invisible to sensory perception. For it is possible to unite with and experience this supersensible domain if one intensifies the inner forces of one's soul to the point where one becomes aware that something of a superhuman and spiritual nature lives in these inner forces of the soul. This connection should not be sought in the way that human connections are sought and pursued in the coarse world of outward sensory existence. For the connection between the human soul and the spiritual world will be found in the intimate forces which the human soul develops when it acquires the inner quality of quiet, calm, attentiveness, a quality that cannot be achieved without training. For in this materialistic age, people have grown accustomed to paying attention only to what is thrust at them forcefully from without, and what, in a certain sense, cries out to their faculties of perception. The spirit that now needs to be experienced inwardly does not cry out, but rather has to be awaited. And it can be approached only by preparing oneself for it as it draws near. Whereas one can say that the phenomena of the outer world, which appear before our senses and demand the attention of our faculties of perception, come toward us and address us directly, one cannot refer in a similar way to the manner in which the spirit, the spiritual world, approaches us. As the language of modern times is, as I have often said, more or less molded for the outer physical world, it is difficult to find words that are an exact reflection of whatever aspect of the spiritual world appears before our soul. But one can, nevertheless, try to show approximately how differently the spiritual and physical worlds approach man. One could say that the spiritual world is experienced through the feeling of gratitude that one has when experiencing it. Take special note of these words: we owe a debt of gratitude to the spiritual world. Our relationship to the physical world is such that we say that the mineral kingdom is spread out before our senses, and from it proceed the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and then our own human kingdom. Within this human world, we feel ourselves in a certain sense as being in a superior position in the sequence of these kingdoms of the outer world. With respect to the spiritual realms, we are aware of our inferior position and of the other realms, those of the Angeloi, Archangeloi, Archai, and so on, as being far above us. We feel that at every moment we are supported by these beings and continually summoned into life by them. We are grateful to them. We look up to them and say, our own life, all that lives in our soul, flows down to us from the will-impregnated thoughts of the beings dwelling in these realms, and constantly forms us. This feeling of personal gratitude to the higher realms should be just as alive in us as the feelings that outer impressions arouse within us as we perceive them physically. If both these feelings, those that outer sensory phenomena exert upon us, and our awareness that what lives in the very center of our being is owed to the higher hierarchies, are equally alive in our soul, we are then in that state of balance whereby we can continue rightly to perceive the interplay between the spiritual and physical domains, a collaborative process which is taking place continually, but which cannot be perceived without the feelings that have been characterized being in a state of balance. An evolution that leads into the future must proceed in such a way that through the presence of these two feelings in the human soul, additional forces enter into earthly evolution which are not able to prosper there in the present materialistic age. Such a statement clearly implies that there have been considerable changes in the course of human evolution. Only in the earliest period of human evolution was there a connection with the spiritual world, albeit in a dimly conscious form. In the early stage of their evolution, human beings did not only have the two states of consciousness that they have now, namely waking and sleeping, together with a chaotic dream life, but they had a third state of consciousness, which did not merely consist of dreams, but was a capacity to perceive the world in pictures out of a dulled condition of consciousness, in pictures that corresponded to a spiritual reality. As we know, it was necessary for this way of perceiving the world to give way to the development of a fully earthbound consciousness. Man would not have become free if he had not been exposed to all the dangers, challenges, and temptations of materialism. However, he must also find his way back to the spiritual world, whose mysteries he must fathom in full earthly consciousness. This is connected with far-reaching changes in the way that people here perceive the world in the course of human evolution, on the lines that we have just indicated. Living in constant communion with souls that had departed from physical existence was a purely natural state of affairs for people in ancient times, which did not require any proof. For in that state of consciousness, where they perceived the spiritual world in pictures, they lived together with those who through their karma were connected in some way with them in life and had passed into the spiritual world through the portal of death. They knew quite simply that the dead are there. They are not dead, they are alive, albeit in a different form of existence. Something that one perceives does not need to be proved. There was no need to ponder about immortality in former ages of human evolution, for people experienced the so-called dead for themselves. However, this communion with the dead had other consequences of a far-reaching nature. It was at that time easier for the dead than it is now. I am not saying that it is impossible at present, but that it was easier then than now, to collaborate with people here on the earth, with what is going on, and thus enable things to proceed as they should. Thus, in these early times of human evolution, what took place on the earth happened in such a way that the dead were active in people's will impulses, in everything that they did and sought to accomplish. Materialism has not only brought forth materialistic ideas, this would be the least harmful of its legacies, for materialistic ideas as such represent its least harmful aspect. It has given rise to a completely different form of coexistence with the spiritual world. It has become far less possible for the so-called dead to take an active part here in the evolution of the earth through the so-called living. And a connection with the dead of this nature is a relationship that mankind needs to reestablish. However, this will only be possible if people learn to understand the language of the dead, and the language through which one can communicate with the dead is none other than that of spiritual science. It may certainly seem, initially, that what spiritual science imparts to us is for the most part concerned with matters pertaining to spiritual erudition, such as world evolution, human evolution, and the various members of man's being. And many people may well say that such things are of little interest to them. They want something that kindles their enthusiasm and warms their hearts. This is a very laudable demand. But the question is how far satisfying such a demand, to a certain extent, can take us. It seems that we are only learning how the earth has evolved on Saturn, Sun, and Moon, how the various cultural epochs on the earth have run their course, and how the members of man's being can be distinguished. But by focusing our thoughts on these seemingly abstract but actually very real matters, by endeavoring to think in such a way that these things can really be beheld in pictures, we are learning to preoccupy ourselves in a particular way with thoughts and ideas which we could not bring before our souls in any other way. If we come truly to feel how our ideas are transformed when we study these spiritual scientific insights, a time will come when we will find it just as absurd to say that we are not interested in concerning ourselves with these things as it would be for a child to say that it had no interest in learning about the trivialities of the ABC, but wants to be able to speak. When compared with what a living language can impart to us, the process that the child has to undergo in its bodily existence when learning to speak is no less abstract than are the ideas of spiritual science when contrasted with the thoughts, ideas, and feelings aroused in the soul under the influence of these spiritual scientific concepts. This does, of course, require patience, for it is necessary to assimilate spiritual science not as an abstract body of ideas, but as a living substance. With regard to what we now have in view, this is quite a remote possibility for people today. In a somewhat different way, however, they also have a certain affinity for it, for they are accustomed to being more or less content when they have focused their attention on a particular object or theme, such as a work of art of some sort or a scientific study. But if they see something for a second time, the tendency today is to say, "I know this already. I have already dealt with it." This is life lived in the abstract. But in other domains, where life is evaluated in accordance with its actual realities, its essential substance, one does not proceed in such a way. Thus one is not likely to meet someone to whom one offers lunch, and who then excuses himself for not wanting to eat on the grounds that he has already eaten yesterday, or the day before yesterday. Where such things are concerned, one keeps on repeating the same action. Life is a constant repetition. If the spiritual realm is to become truly alive, and unless it does so, it is unable to bring us in touch with the universality of the world of spirit, we must imitate in our souls what the laws of life have formed in the physical world, which for all its ossified nature has a spiritual origin. In particular, we shall become aware that if with a certain rhythmic regularity we allow such impressions to affect us as presuppose a certain freedom of thought, an emancipation of thinking from the physical world, much is going on within our inner being. The saving grace, if I may use these emotive words, of man's spiritual development will be that people do not settle into relating to spiritual ideas in the way that this tends to happen today, an attitude that can be characterized by statements such as, quote, "Oh, I know that already, I have heard it all before," close quote. But instead regard these ideas as being like life itself, which is always associated with repetition, with what I might call a recurrence of the same phenomenon at the same place. Thus, if we work toward imbuing our soul with spiritual life, our inner attentiveness also increases. It becomes so intimate that we are able inwardly to call to mind those important moments in which the connections with the spiritual world that speak most directly to our heart can be nurtured. Significant moments for engaging with the spiritual world are, for example, those of falling asleep and waking. The moment of falling asleep will be less fruitful for most people at the beginning of their spiritual development, because immediately after going to sleep, their consciousness will be so dulled that they will not perceive the world of spirit. But the moment of passing from sleep into a waking state, if we do become accustomed not simply to let it pass by unobserved, but try to pay attention to it by endeavoring to wake up in such a way that, although consciousness has dawned, the world around us does not immediately approach us with its raw brutality, can be highly productive. In this respect, there is much of value in the folk customs of olden times that is little understood today. Simple people who have little acquaintance with intellectual culture will say that when you wake up, you should not look immediately at the light. Thus, instead of having an immediate raw impression of the outside world, one should remain in a state of wakefulness without receiving impressions of one's surroundings. If this can be achieved, it is at this moment of waking possible to see those dead people with whom we have a karmic connection approaching us. They do not only approach us at such times, but this is the best opportunity to perceive them. At such a time, we do not only have perceptions of this nature, but we also see what is taking place between us and the dead people concerned in the time outside these moments. For one's perception of the spiritual world is not bound up with time in the same way as one's perception of the physical world. Herein lies a difficulty with respect to comprehending the essential nature of the spiritual world. One moment of perception can momentarily and fleetingly reveal to us something from the spiritual world that extends over a wide expanse of time. The difficulty lies in having sufficient presence of mind to grasp in the moment what is spread out over greater periods of time. For, as is indeed generally the case, the moment may pass by in status nascendi. It is forgotten as soon as it arises. This is an inherent difficulty in comprehending the spiritual world. Were it not for this, a large number of people would, especially in our present time, already be receiving impressions of the spiritual world. There are also other moments in life when it is possible for the spiritual world to reach through to us. One example is when we form a thought in such a way that it springs forth from us. If we simply abandon ourselves to life and flow with the stream, there is little likelihood that the real, true, and inwardly vibrant spiritual world will be active within us. Whereas in the moment when we inwardly take an initiative, when we are confronted with the decision that we have to make ourselves, even if only about something very trivial, this again is a particularly favorable moment for the dead people who are karmically connected with us to enter our sphere of consciousness. Such moments do not need to be important in the sense of what one terms important in outward material life. Indeed, what is important as a spiritual experience may sometimes not appear to have any great significance in one's outer life. But to someone who has insight into such matters, it is absolutely clear that these experiences, which, while perhaps having little outward significance, are inwardly of such great importance, have deep karmic associations. Thus it is necessary to observe soul processes of a more intimate nature if one wishes to arrive at an understanding of the spiritual world. It may, for example, occur that someone is walking along the street or sitting in his room and is startled by an unexpected bang or a sound that he had not anticipated. After his shock, he may have a moment of quiet reflection, which makes him aware that something important was revealed to him from the spiritual world during this shock. One needs to pay attention to these things. Generally speaking, people do not have any awareness of this aspect, since they are preoccupied with the shock that they received, and are only able to dwell on this. This is why it is so important to acquire an inner sense of balance, as indicated at the end of my book Theosophy, or entitled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, for if this can be acquired, one will not be so perplexed after such a shock that one dwells merely on one's sense of alarm, and the nature of what one has experienced in such an apparently insignificant, but nevertheless, in an inward sense, highly important moment, will become clearly apparent, albeit in an intimate way. These are, of course, only initial steps, which must be developed further. For by developing these capacities of being attentive to the moment of waking, and being attentive to the moment when we are disturbed by an outward event of one kind or another, we learn to discover our connection with the wider cosmos, comprising, as it does, both material and spiritual aspects, to which we belong, and from which we have become separated, with the object, to be sure, of becoming free human beings, but which is indeed the source whence we originated. The truth is that, as was an accepted fact in ancient times, man is not a sort of cosmic hermit who wanders about the earth like a lost soul, as people believe now. On the contrary, he is, as was acknowledged in ancient times, part of the great cosmic whole, just as a finger is a member of our bodily organism. People today, or at any rate the majority of people, no longer feel themselves to be members of the great organism of the cosmos, in so far as it comes visibly to expression as a spiritual reality. Nevertheless, a reflection on ordinary scientific insights could teach us today that we and our lives are members of the whole cosmic order of which our own organism is a part. Let us take a very simple example, which anyone can confirm for himself through a simple calculation. We all know that in spring on 21 March, the sun rises at a definite point in the heavens. We call this the vernal point. However, we also know that this vernal point is not the same every year, but that it moves forward. We know that the sun now rises in the constellation of the fishes. Before the 15th century, it rose in the ram. parenthesis, astronomy continues to say in the Ram or in Aries, which is not correct. However, this incidental remark can be disregarded for now, close parenthesis. So the vernal point progresses. The sun rises a little further on in the zodiac every spring. It is easy to see from this that over a certain period, it will have moved through the whole zodiac, that the position of the dawn will have traveled through the entire zodiacal circle. Now the time that is necessary for the sun to move through the whole zodiac is approximately 25,920 years. So if you calculate the vernal point for any particular year, it will have moved forward in the following year, when 25,920 years have elapsed, the vernal point returns to the same point. Here, 25,920 is a highly significant period for our solar system. The sun takes what I might describe as a cosmic step when the position of the dawn returns to the same point. Plato, the great Greek philosopher, referred to these 25,920 years as a cosmic year, the great Platonic year. All this is already very remarkable. But if we consider the following, we can see the infinite depth and significance of the whole remarkable picture. A human being normally takes 18 breaths in a minute. This varies in that, in childhood, they are somewhat more frequent, and in old age, less so. But on average, it would be correct to say that a normal person takes 18 breaths. If on this basis we work out how many breaths are taken in a day, it is a simple calculation. 18 times 60, which makes 1,080 in an hour. Multiply that by 24, and we arrive at 25,920 breaths in a day. You see from this that the same number governs the human day with respect to our breaths as the great cosmic year is governed by this number in the passage of the vernal point through the zodiac. This is one of the signs which shows us that we are not just talking in a general, vague, and dimly mystical way when we say that the microcosm is an image of the macrocosm, but that as regards an important function on which his life depends at every moment, man is governed by the same number and measure as the course of the sun within which his own life has also lived. Now let us consider another aspect of this. The patriarchal age, as it is generally called, is 70 human years. Of course, this does not mean that every person has to live for 70 years. Some people may live much longer, for man is a free being, and such thresholds may well be exceeded. Nevertheless, let us keep to this patriarchal age and say that a human being lives on average for 70 or 71 years. Let us work out how many days that is on the basis that there are 365 and a quarter days in a year. If we multiply this by 70, we get 25,567.5. If we multiply it by 71, we arrive at 25,932.75. From this, you can see that the point of time when human life encompasses exactly 25,920 days lies between the ages of 70 and 71. So the patriarchal age lasts for 25,920 days. So a human day is defined as having 25,920 breaths, and a human life as having 25,920 days. Let us now investigate something else, which can now be done quite simply. You will see quite easily that if I divide the 25,920 years that the vernal point of the sun needs to pass through the zodiac by 365.25, I shall arrive at approximately 70 or 71, in that I arrived at the same figures through multiplication. That is to say, if I regard the Platonic year as one great year and divide it in such a way that I define the length of a day, I discover what a day is in terms of a Platonic year. What is it? It is the course of a human life. The course of a human life is related to the Platonic year, as a day in a person's life is related to a year. The air is all around us. We breathe it in and breathe it out. The numerical rhythm of this process is such that 25,920 breaths are equivalent to one day in our life. What then is a day in our life? It has a rhythm whereby our ego and astral body leave our physical and ether bodies and return to them again. Thus, day after day, the ego and astral body leave and return, just as our breath is exhaled and inhaled. Many of our friends will recall that, in order to make this clear, I have in public lectures compared this alternation of waking and sleeping to a deep breath. So just as we exhale and inhale air when we breathe, our astral body and ego leave and return to our ether and physical bodies when we go to sleep and wake up again. This amounts to saying that a being exists, or can be presumed to exist, that breathes in and out, just as we fulfill this function in an 1/18 of a minute. And the breathing of this being is directly related to the leaving and returning of our astral body and ego. This being is none other than the living being of the earth, in that the earth experiences day and night. It is breathing, and its breathing process bears our sleeping and waking on its wings. This is the breathing process of a greater being. And now let us consider the breathing process of the greater being of the sun, encircling the heavens. Just as, for the earth, a day elapses as the ego and astral body depart from and re-engage with man's physical and etheric bodies, the great being, corresponding spiritually to the sun, brings us human beings into existence. For our 70 to 71 years are, as we have demonstrated, a day in the sun year of the great Platonic year. Our entire human life is an out-breathing and in-breathing of this great being to whom the Platonic year is assigned. Thus, you see, we draw one small breath in an 1/18 of a minute, which regulates our life. We are involved in the life of the earth, whose breathing rhythm encompasses day and night, and this corresponds to the rhythm whereby our ego and astral body leave and return to our physical and ether bodies, and we are ourselves breathed out by the great being, whose life corresponds to the course of the sun. Our life is a breath of this great being. You see then that as microcosms, we are fully part of the macrocosm, and are subject to the same laws as regards the beings of the universe as our breathing is subject with respect to our own human nature. Everything is governed by number and measure. But what is so amazing, deeply meaningful, and profoundly moving for our hearts is that number and measure govern the wider cosmos, the macrocosm, and the microcosm in a similar way. This is not merely a figure of speech, not merely something that is mystically felt, but something that a wisdom-filled contemplation of the world teaches us, namely that we stand as microcosms within the macrocosm. If one makes these very simple calculations, for they can, of course, be arrived at by means of the most ordinary methods of arithmetic, and if one does not have a heart like a block of wood, but one is sensitive to the mysteries of cosmic existence, a statement such as, quote, "we are part of the cosmic whole," close quote, ceases to be purely abstract and becomes deeply alive. A knowledge and a feeling will blossom and flourish and bear fruit in impulses of the will, and the whole of humanity will live the all-encompassing life of divine cosmic existence. This is the path on which we may find to some extent a means of forming a link to the spiritual world, and it must be found, as already indicated in the previous lecture, during the time when Christ will dwell etherically on the earth. I have even referred to the year when he began to move about etherically on our earth. He must be found. But people must become accustomed to perceiving the connection, the very intimate connection, that is already established with cosmic existence. A connection which, when it is perceived, will ensure that the need, the intense longing, arises to seek this union with the spiritual world. For it will not be long before people will be compelled to realize one thing, which is the following. If one is dulled by materialism, it is indeed possible to deny the spiritual world. But one cannot kill the inner forces which have the capacity to seek a connection with it. One can delude oneself as to the existence of a spiritual world, but one cannot kill the soul forces which have the potential to bring man into communion with the spiritual world. This has a very significant consequence, of which one needs to be aware, especially in our time. Namely, that where forces exist that have an effect, even if one denies them, the materialist does not forbid the forces of his soul that incline toward the spiritual world from having an effect. He cannot do so, for they have an effect anyway. You may ask whether someone who has these spiritually inclined forces within him can be a materialist. Yes, he can. They are active within him. Whatever he may think about it, they are at work within him. But what effect do they have in such a case? Forces that are present in any situation can indeed be suppressed as regards their own original influence, but they are then transformed into other forces. And if one does not use the forces that would reach toward the spiritual realm in order to seek an understanding of this domain, I speak now only of understanding, since that is all that is necessary to begin with, they are transformed into forces of illusion in human life. Their effect is then such that people in ordinary life abandon themselves to all manner of illusions with respect to the world around them. That this should be so is not without significance in our time. For at no time have people indulged their imagination as they do today, even though they have no love for imagination. Imagination is not restricted to particular areas. If one were to begin to give examples of what people who want to be mere realists and materialists imagine, one could shed light on all sorts of things, and there would be no end of it. Although I do not want to engage in heresies, one might, by way of an example, begin to take a look at what certain people, statesmen, for instance, have prophesied no more than a few weeks ago about the probable course of events in the world, and then cast one's eye, EYE, over what has actually happened. If one compares these things, one will find that the capacity for illusion has, for quite some years, been far from small. If one investigates all areas of life in this way, it is quite remarkable to note the extent to which this capacity for illusion exists everywhere today. This capacity for illusion at times endows the attitudes and opinions of materialistically inclined people with a childlike, even perhaps a childish, quality. When one sees what is needed for people to understand one another, or to try to spell something out to them, one will get some idea of what I mean when I say childlike or even childish. Well, this is how things are. If people turn away from the spiritual world, they must pay for it by becoming prone to illusions, by losing the capacity to have appropriate concepts about outward physical reality and the course of outward events. Their imagination is then directed toward another realm because they have a disregard for truth, irrespective of whether it relates to spiritual or physical reality. I once gave you an obvious example, which, even though it relates to matters within our own circles, is nevertheless quite typical. one frequently experiences discussions where the spiritual science advocated by me is the subject of negative judgments. These judgments are based on the assertion that everything I have said is pure fantasy, and such flights of fancy are not permitted. So these people do not want to accompany us into the true spiritual world, because they consider it to be purely fanciful, and they despise such fanciful imaginations. And then they formulate all sorts of arguments, whose relationship to the reality in question is no greater than that of white to black. For example, about my own antecedents, about the way that I did this or that in my life. In this way, they develop the boldest fantasies. Here you see the coexistence of a repudiation of the spiritual world and a capacity for illusion. The people concerned do not notice this, but it accords with an absolute law. A certain amount of energy is directed toward the spiritual world and a certain amount toward the physical world. If the quantum of energy available for the spiritual world is not used for this purpose, it is directed toward the physical world, not in order to grasp the truth of earthly reality, but to plunge people into illusions concerning their lives today. This cannot be similarly observed in each individual case, so that one can necessarily say in every instance that this person has fallen prey to illusion through his rejection of the spiritual world. Such examples can indeed be found, but they have to be searched for. And the reason that they cannot so easily be detected is that life is complicated, and one person influences the other. It is always the case that a stronger soul influences weaker souls, so that if one finds a certain capacity to cherish illusions in one person, the reason for this tendency lies in a hatred for, or a rejection of, the spiritual world. But this does not necessarily reside in the soul of the person who is swayed by illusions and may have been suggested to him. In spiritual domains, the danger of infection is far greater than in any physical domain. In the next lecture, when we shall take what we have been considering today further and connect it with the Christ mystery and the mystery of our present time, so as to gain some insight into the significance of the spiritual outlook as a whole, we shall endeavor to discover how what has been under discussion here is connected with the general karma of humanity, and how these matters, when considered in the light of the important law of the metamorphosis of soul forces, oriented toward the spiritual world into forces of illusion, exert an influence in the whole context of life, and are associated with the developmental circumstances of our present age and of the immediate future. The end of Lecture 2.